So we're on week three, with our friend here, and I'd like to introduce to you Tom V.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Tom.
Hi, Tom.
And hopefully you guys can hear me okay.
Yes.
And the first 2 weeks we went through the beginning of the book and the doctor's opinion, which talked about the allergy and started to reference the spiritual part of the program. And then we went through Bill's story, which is just jam-packed with so much in there. And Bill talked about his problem and then his solution. So here we are in Chapter 2 on page 17. And what I was taught by my teachers was that this chapter has two things that are paramount. One of it is the fellowship, which on its own is not sufficient. And the second part is the spiritual awakening. And in this chapter, we'll go back to what we touched on in the doctor's opinion, which was that back on page 567, that spiritual experience. But we're not there yet. But this is where the book's formally in print pushes us back into that part of it. So on this first page 17, there's a whole bunch of promises on this page, and I'd just like to go over this page if I could with you. And it starts out by saying, "We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem." That's my first promise. This is telling me that in this book there's going to be this solution to my problem. So there's that word recovered in the first paragraph. If you're not sure what that is, you can go back to page 84 on the bottom of that page. And what I was taught is that bottom paragraph and the next three paragraphs describe recovered. So this page goes on to say, "We are average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix, but there exists among us a fellowship of friendliness and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We are like the passengers of a great liner the moment after rescue from shipwreck, with camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element of the powerful cement which binds us. But that, in itself, would never have held us together as we are now joined." So that's the warning. That's the part about the fellowship is not sufficient. So I'm a Joe and Charlie guy, so I don't know if you've had the opportunity to listen to Joe and Charlie. They were circuit speakers that went around, and they're very popular. My sponsor is into them, and that's how I got my exposure. But he talks about the fellowship part and what was described. Of we're normally not people that would be put together. If we took a poll, which we're not going to do, and disclose what our different occupations are, what our education levels are, what our interests are, what music we like, we probably would sit here and say, I would really normally never be with this person, or I would never hang out with these people. I don't have anything in common. What we do have in common is we have this allergy, and we're here looking for a solution. So Joe and Charlie talk about, and they refer to this steerage to the captain's table. So they refer back to back in the day of an ocean liner, and this ocean liner was divided in between the haves and the have-nots. The ones that had money stayed on the upper decks, and they were kind of isolated. They used separate stairwells, and they never really had any contact with the individuals that were not as fortunate materialistically. But yet they refer to the disaster of the Titanic, and they say that at that time there's a man standing at the rail in a tuxedo and his shiny shoes and his bow tie, and standing next to him is a man in overalls and work shoes and has never worn a tie in his life. What do they have in common? Nothing at that moment. But the minute they jumped over that rail, and they say when their butts hit that cold water, they had a common bind, and that was to save their life. And that's what they... And that night, they entered out together, hanging on to each other, hoping to save their life. This is what AA has come to me. This is what it means to me, this book, the fellowship, all of you in my life. That's the common thing that brings me with you and binds me to you. And so that's what this first part talks about. And it says the last paragraph, the tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree, upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. So there's a bunch of promises here that tell me if I want to follow through with this book and keep going, and if I can absorb and I'm agreeing and believing and have faith and moving forward with what's suggested, that I have a pretty good chance of recovering. So the next page, it talks about an illness of this sort. So what are they talking about? Well, this is the allergy, if you go back to the doctor's opinion that Dr. Silkworth talked about. And we have come to believe it an illness involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him and no one is angry or hurt, but not so with the alcoholic illness. So this is this whole thing of what's wrong with you, you have no willpower, you're a degenerate, why don't you just stop? And it'll go on to some of those examples in a couple of pages. But further down the page, and it's in squiggly writing, right? So what does that mean? Everybody knows, right? It's expensive. It costs more to write in squiggly writing. And Clancy talks about this, you know, the one alcoholic talking to another. So it says, but the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who is properly armed with facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. So that comes back to me in Bill's first meeting with Dr. Bob, where he was only going to give him a half an hour, but they stayed 4.5 hours. It's my personal experience of going through therapy, counseling, attorneys, arrests, family members in my face, what's wrong with you, but yet sitting with another person that's describing their hopelessness, that's describing their feelings of loneliness, the feelings of, you know, the jumping off point. I have to end this. I don't know what to do. I can't stop. That connection was something that was just there. It came. And I didn't know who the person was, but I would hear them come in when I was in detox or rehab, and they would tell their stories. There was this connection there. So that's the fellowship. That's that part of the program of recovery. So if we flip on to the next page, on page 19, there's a part in there that has come, and I'm not criticizing the book. For me, it was too early on in this book for me to have this idea, and it's on the bottom of the page, and it says, third paragraph from the bottom, most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions are attitudes which make us more useful to others. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. So this is talking to me about getting out of myself. The first time, this makes perfect sense to me today, and it did a few years ago, was when I began to understand it. When I first came into the program and I read that, I was so locked in self, I was so selfish, self-centered, that I couldn't even, I'm going to have constant thought of others, and that's going to be part of my solution. I wasn't there. I couldn't grasp that. But that's the part in the fellowship that also allowed me to have exposure. See, I believe in my mind's eye that we're all in this lifeboat and we're all hanging on for dear life. And if we see someone going too close to the edge or hanging off the edge, I'm supposed to pull them back in. I'm supposed to reach out. What does that mean? To me, it means to pick up the phone and call them. Hey, where you been? I haven't seen you in a while. Not to give them a hard time or yell at them, but to truly concerned. You're okay. Is there anything I can do for you? To try to bring someone in and give them a reason to be involved in AA. Help out with a coffee commitment. We want to come along on a speaking commitment with you. Keep them involved. My sponsor has taught me to say to other men that I see drifting away, don't drift too far. Don't go too far away from the program. And that's what these few sentences mean to me in the fellowship. It's talking to me about the tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints. I may hear something in a meeting where I say, that's it, I'm out of here, I don't want to be here. I don't agree with that. But I've got to be able to take a look at that and allow them. You know, I talk about, you know, the flip-flop meeting, the dog ate my flip-flops, and that takes up about 20 minutes of the meeting, how someone's talk. I was taught if that's enough to make them feel they need to drink, let them talk, let them speak. I know I'm drifting off on this, but this to me was very important, was for me, you know, because I'm judging. I can judge sometimes in a meeting. I can judge just like you're judging me right now. And say and critique somebody and how they're, well, I don't feel that way. I don't like that. I didn't like the way they said. And that's not really what this is about. That's not what the program was about. But these few, they're six sentences. We're here to remind me that my life as an ex-problem drinker depends on our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. So that's enough on that one. But a little further down in the middle of this page, it reminds me again about this book. It says, it is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. We shall tell you what we have done. Before going into a detailed discussion, it may be well to summarize some points as we see them. So this is this whole thing about, I was talking about my family and my face or whoever it may be, what's the matter with you, can't you stop? So it says, how many times have people said to us, I can take it or leave it alone, why can't he? Why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit? That fellow can't handle his liquor, and so on and so forth. And all of it, the doctor told him that if he ever drank again, it would kill him. But there he is, all lit up again. So this relates to me about my powerlessness. I'm hopeless. There's other people in the room that are telling me how powerless they are, how hopeless they are, and I'm beginning to come together and to get this bond and to have the glue that's going to hold me together, that's going to attract me to this. To this guy and say, hey, where are you going? You want to go have a cup of coffee, or I'm going here, or I'm going there. You want to come? So, next page, 21. Here comes the real good part, second paragraph. But what about the real alcoholic? Okay, because I'm a real alcoholic. My first sponsor told me I suffer from terminal uniqueness. I came in and I was different, and I weren't like the rest of you, and my problems are greater than yours, and if you had a job like mine, if you had a wife like mine, if you had, you know, you drink too. And he reminded me, you know, like, so if you're a real alcoholic, here you are, Tom, you're on page 21, and it tells me he may start off as a moderate drinker, he may not become a continuous hard drinker, but at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. So that's the phenomenon of craving, right? We kick that off. There's this allergy. So all of these examples are in here and presented to me to see if I can make this connection. Do I really need to be here? Am I one of you? It goes on to describe, you know, he does absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking. He is a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He is seldom mildly intoxicated. So I'm a nice guy, you know. Take the alcohol and the dry goods away from me. I'm a really nice guy. You'd want to hang out with me. But the minute you put alcohol or drugs in me, there's this change, and I'm this Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and I go through this transformation, and you know, I don't know where I'm going. I don't know what I'm doing. I wasn't a blackout drinker like I described, but it was game on. So a little further down, he is often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except alcohol, but in that respect, he is incredibly dishonest and selfish. Raise my hand, because that will describe me. So what they're trying to put together this glue, something there in this book that's attracting me to say, okay, I can identify with this. Yes, I get this. It's also presenting to me the part of the insanity, because we're going to be coming up. We're not there yet, but we're starting to come into step two. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. So this book is now dropping all of these little things in here about the insanity. The insanity, simply put for me and best described, is I can't drink safely anymore. That's about the easiest caveman way I can explain. I can't drink safely anymore. There's no doubt that the minute I put alcohol and drugs in, it's going to be ugly. And we just don't know how ugly it's going to be. I'm not a sociable drinker. I'm not the kind of guy that's going to sit there and be happy and tell jokes. I might for 15 minutes, but it's going to switch. And looking at my videotape and my story, it's just not good. So that part of me thinking that, yes, this time will be different. Yes, I'm going to be all right, right? I'll just drink the brown liquor, or I'll do the beer experiment that Dr. Bob did, or you know, and I'll only drink on weekends, and all. It's not. I'm done. Right? Once a pickle, always a pickle. You're not going back to a cucumber, and that's the way this works. It says he often possesses special abilities, skills, and aptitudes, and has a promising career ahead of him. He uses his gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, and then pulls the structure down on his head with a senseless series of sprees. So, next page. It goes on and it describes for me on page 22. It talks about again top of the page. He searches madly for the bottle he misplaced the night before. If he can afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over the house to be certain no one gets his entire supply away from him to throw down the waste pipe. As matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedatives and liquor to quiet his nerves. If you remember, Bill was talking about that in Bill's story. Mine was Xanax, Jack Daniels, and cocaine, all those three together, was my recipe for happiness. But then it wasn't anymore. So then it says, then comes the day when he simply cannot make it and gets drunk all over again. Perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine or some sedative with which to taper off. Then he begins to appear at hospitals and sanitariums. So when I read all of that, I could absolutely identify with it. Because my story in my last 2 years was two detoxes, two rehabs, hospitals, emergency rooms, not being able to make it to meetings, not being able to show up for family functions, and my Xanax and my chemicals and my alcohol. This was the way I lived my life. It was horrible. It was ugly. So it also says that if you can identify with any of this, of what we've read up to this point, it says this is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic, or our behavior patterns vary, but this description should identify him roughly. So if there's something when you read this chapter that you can pick up and identify, you have to remember, you know, this book was written in 1939. I don't have to tell you what the date is today. This means something. I came in the rooms in 2007. Although I was foggy and I really couldn't grasp it, and I had a whole bunch of resentments and fear and that contempt prior to investigation, there was so much in here that kept me, here in this chapter, that kept me in the rooms. And that's the other part of the fellowship. You hear, don't leave before the miracle. Just, you know, hang on. And it is a process. It does take time. I'm not the kind of guy who got it the first time. I needed some beating. So why does he behave like this if hundreds of experience have shown him that one drink means another debacle with all its attendant suffering and humiliation? Why is it that he takes that one drink? It's a question. So they're asking. Why can't he stay on the water wagon? There's another question. What has become of the common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? Do you understand what that's it's saying? That when I don't have alcohol and drugs, and I'm a successful business. When I came in to the program, I was a successful businessman up until the last few years. I had done a lot of achieve. I was in the construction field. I had my own business, built a lot of beautiful buildings, had gotten some awards for them. I'm not bragging. I'm just trying to give you an indication of what I'm talking about here. And my achievements, my decisions, not everything in my life was a disaster. But when it came to alcohol and being sober and staying sober, I knew nothing. I was ignorant. I didn't know any of it. So my decision-making up to that point, brown liquor, I'll try wine, I'll just try beer, I'll only drink. All of that scenario that I ran through was useless. Those decisions that I was making were not anything that was going to help me. So why is that? Why does that happen? So on page 23 is my answer. And in this paragraph right here, it says, these observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle into motion. Here it is. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. Huge. It's underlined, it's highlighted, it's bolded. For me, I had to understand that my problem's here, between my ears. That's my real problem, because if I just put it down, if I come out of rehab and they've got it out of my system, or detox, and they have it out of my system, I do not have that craving anymore. It's gone. My body is not screaming for it. But what is screaming for it is what's rattling around between my ears. This is bringing me right up into step two. This is pushing me into that whole part of I'm insane. I'm crazy. We talked last week about Bill on Armistice Day. He told this gentleman, he sat with him for hours, his whole story, his disaster, relapse after relapse, and financial hardship, and he and Lois having to move around, and how alcohol was the sole cause of that. But yet Bill walked into the bar, they placed a drink, we're going to buy you a drink, the bartender said, for Armistice Day, and Bill picked it up without thinking. And he talks about it on page 5. If you go back to page 5 for a minute, bottom of the page. Shortly afterwards, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? ? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone pushed a drink my way. I had taken it. Was I crazy? ? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. I've experienced that. I have experienced just that, and that's what these sentences are saying to me. Therefore, the main problem of this alcoholic centers in my mind rather than in my body. So, I now need to deal with this. I have to go figure out where is my solution. Because the title of this chapter is, There is a Solution, 1. So, it goes on. Talks about once in a while he may tell the truth. Yes, you're right. And the truth, strange to say, usually that he has no more idea why he took the first drink than you have. There have been times when I went out and said, I'm gonna get drunk. That's that was my mission. But there were times where I would say, I'm only gonna stop off for one. Friday night, worked hard this week, going to hang out with the guys from the office, or I'm going to stop and see my brother, or I'm going to stop and see my sister. You know, my sister can have two glasses of wine, because she used to be able to before her MS, but put her head on the pillow, get up and go to work. My brother's the same thing. I don't understand why I can't do that. We come from the same parents. So it says on the bottom of the page, the tragic truth is that if the man be a real alcoholic, so what is a real alcoholic? Okay, I'm glad you asked. So if you go to page 44, let's get a brief glimpse of what that is. I know we're jumping ahead, but this all makes sense and it's all tied together. So that this is the chapter for we agnostics, all right? And it says in the first paragraph are just some questions to ask yourself. In the preceding chapters, you have learned something of alcoholism. We hope we have made it clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience can conquer. This whole book is tied together. In other words, what it's saying is, we're screwed. I'm screwed. I'm not going to speak for you. I'm screwed. I have to go find the spiritual experience. So let's go to page 24. And there's squiggly writing. If you see it, right up there in the front. So it's important. It must be important. It says, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against that first drink. So I refer you back. We don't have to do it now, but page 5, the bottom of page 5 that we just read in Bill's story, and that tells you where he was at. I know where I am and where I was. You're going to have to figure that out for yourself as to where you are and whether or not you are a real alcoholic. So, again, it's hammering home this whole thing about what's going on between my ears. And for me, I have this voice in my head that sounds just like me, and it talks to me, and I believe that what it was telling me for so many years was the truth. Luckily, I came in here and I got a sponsor, and I would share some of those things with him. And he would tell me how delusional I am, and he would tell me I'm nuts, and he would, in a kind and loving way. It wasn't a beat down. It was, let's talk about this. Let's see how that would work. And I think we spoke about it the first week. My last detox was Summit Oaks, and as I was leaving, my counselor Otto called me back and said to me, "Tom, if you want to drink, go ahead and drink." Didn't understand that, was confused, but he completed it, and he said, "If you want to drink, go ahead and drink, but if you can think through what's going to happen after that first drink, you got a shot." And that's the part of being recovered. That's the part of that, what we're focusing on right now, that mental blank spot where I can't do that. I can't remember the bad things that happened. So, and that's what this squiggly line paragraph right here is telling me. The alcoholic may say to himself further down the page, in the most casual way, "It won't burn me this time, so here's how," or perhaps he doesn't think at all. How often have some of us begun to drink in this nonchalant way? So here, we're going through this. We're hammering it pretty hard. I think you guys are understanding what my understanding of this book is in these few pages. They're telling me that I got to find something else. They're telling me I'm insane. They're telling me the fellowship is not enough. So if I flip to page 25, squiggly lines again, first full paragraph, there is a solution. Okay, yippee. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings which the process requires for its successful consumption. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness, and futility of life as we had been living it. When therefore we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, this is the fellowship, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence of which we have not even dreamed. So, it goes on, and then on the bottom of the page, again, it's saying to me, if I think I'm special, and I think I'm unique, it says, if you are as seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible, and if we had passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of the entire intolerable situation as best we could. The other, to accept spiritual help. So, if you see on the bottom of the page, there's the appendix fully explained, appendix 2, and that's where we're referred back to, in the fourth edition, it's on page 567. Let's flip back there. In the third edition, it's 569. So we did hit this the first week when we were in the doctor's opinion, because that's where I was at. But I think this is important right now for us to understand. Fourth edition, 567. Third edition, 569. So this is the part that talks to me about describing what a spiritual experience was. I didn't know what that was. It was introduced to me early on when I first came in, and Sergio took me here, and this is where we are right now in the book, and it's so important that it's in this book twice. In We Agnostics, they bang it again and refer you back there, so they're pushing us back here. Obviously, this is important. I should listen to this. So it says, spiritual experience. The term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading show that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. So that's describing to me the basic or the blueprint of a spiritual experience. It's a personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many members the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of a sudden and spectacular upheaval. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. So what that means is, if you remember in Bill's story, he talked about being in his room finally at the end, and this white light came to him, and he felt the rush of the wind upon him, and he was having what he came to describe as a white light experience, which was his spiritual experience. If you get any of his tapes, again, plugs, you know, silkworth.net. You got XA Speakers is a great resource for tapes. You get any of Bill's tapes, he'll describe this in many of his recordings. I didn't get that. I didn't get that experience. So if I'm reading this and I don't keep going, I'm thinking, well, okay, this isn't for me, because this didn't happen. What happened to Bill didn't happen to me in Bill's story. What I just read didn't happen to me. So let's keep reading. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described, though it was not our intention to create such an impression. Many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. That's that white light thing. Okay. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Whew. Okay. I think I have a little hope now. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource which they presently identify with their own conception of a power, capital P, greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of a spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover. Page 84, if you need to know. Provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts, he can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Squiggly lines, willingness, honesty, and an open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is the bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation, Herbert Spencer. So it's telling me I don't have to have that white light experience. It's telling me that I still have a chance of recovery. That contempt prior to investigation, remember the Brussels sprout story with my mother, I'm not eating those, but you've never had, okay, you've heard that before. All right. So let's go on to page 26. And now he's going to give an example like all great workbooks do, of a real example of someone, a certain American businessman, had ability, good sense, and higher character. For years he had floundered from one sanitarium to another. He had consulted the best-known American psychiatrist. So this gentleman he's referring to is Roland Hazard. Google him up, Silkworth. Do some, you know, don't let me read your big book for you. Dig into it. You guys get into it. But he was born up in Rhode Island, 1881. He died in Connecticut, 1945. He was a businessman. He came from money. He had a lot of money. But that didn't matter, right? We hear Park Avenue, Park Bench, this disease does not discriminate. Well, he was involved in manufacturing, processing, and actually his family ultimately turned into the company called Allied Chemical. Roland got involved in the group, the Oxford Group, back in that time, which was a group of people that had a spiritual base that wanted to help people. The Oxford Group was paramount in Bill's recovery. He was involved in Dr. Bob's recovery. And that group existed. So that this story is about Roland Hazard. It's describing Roland. It's talking about how he stayed with the psychiatrist, Dr. Young, who prescribed for him. Though experience had made him skeptical, he finished the treatment. He stayed with Dr. Jung supposedly for a year, a little over a year, and met with him every day. He lived there with him in Europe. And they went through this whole transformation. And as the story goes, Roland left, went to meet his family in France for dinner, and Roland drank immediately. So what happened, right? That mental blank spot, page 5 in Dr. Bill's story, describes how what happened with Bill. So he comes back to the doctor, and on the bottom of the page, he begged the doctor to tell him the whole truth, and he got it. In the doctor's judgment, he was utterly hopeless. He could never regain his position in society and would have to be placed, he would have to place himself under lock and key or hire a bodyguard if he expected to live long. That was the great physician's opinion. So the story goes that the way it was told on the tapes that I listened to was that he went back, said to Dr. Young, here I am, it didn't work, let's hit it again. And the doctor said, I can't help you. He said, there's nothing I can do. He said, well, I've got a checkbook and I got a lot of money, I'll write you a check. And he said, I can't help you. And see, this is the beautiful part of this for me, of me understanding how God and my God plays out in this, is if we go back, Dr. Silkworth talked about the allergy. He's not an alcoholic. Dr. Young talks about the spiritual part of it. He's not an alcoholic either, but you put these two people together and they're forming this book. They have nothing in common, but yet they're still tied back together. How does this happen? How does this all come together for this book to come into my possession? For me, not that it was written for me. But I truly believe that. I don't think God wants to see us suffer. I think God has another plan for me. I'm not going to speak for you. I know for me he does. And that's to carry this message. And it's exactly what I read on the bottom of page 19, beginning of 20. Get out of myself and go help somebody else. So let's go on to page 28. And it says here, we in our turn sought the same escape with all the desperation of drowning men. What seemed at first a flimsy reed has proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. A new life has been given us, or if you prefer, a design for living that really worked. The distinguished American psychologist William James, in his book Varieties of Religious Experience, there's another offer for you to read something, indicates a multitude of ways in which men have discovered God. We have no desire to convince anyone that there is only one way by which faith can be acquired. If what we have learned and felt and seen means anything at all, it means that all of us, whatever our race, creed, our color, are children of a living Creator with whom we may form a relationship upon simple and understandable terms as soon as we are willing. Big word, willing. Remember that. You're going to need that on step 6. And an honest enough to try. Those having religious affiliations will find here nothing disturbing to their beliefs or ceremonies. There is no friction among us over such matters. So don't get hung up over this God thing. And don't get hung up over the words religion. Because if you remember back in Bill's story, Ebby told him, he says, choose your own higher power of your own understanding. And I know men, and I still know men, that their higher powers are cartoon characters, comic book characters, the fellowship. Okay, as long as it's not me. Okay, my higher power can't be me, because it was for a long time and it didn't work. I got to have a different higher power. He's got to be all powerful, and this book is bringing me there, and it's giving me some great things to read and absorb and understand. That's going to open me up, because we're preparing to get into We Agnostics. We have one more chapter to go through that more about alcoholism, which really talks about the insanity. And we'll get into that. Well, let's get into that tonight. Well, let's start that, because I want to talk about my most favorite guy in the whole book, the salesman. But a little whiskey in my milk. So that's where this chapter is. This is what this is doing. It's starting to push me in that direction and to give me a lot of things to think about. So we go to the next page, 30, and this is more about alcoholism. And this is here to give me the truth. So on page 30 and page 31, you guys do this yourself. I want you to go through here and find the word control on these two pages. Highlight them and count them. I have them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times on these two pages. They're using the word control. There's a reason for that. I don't have any. I have no control. And in this chapter, they're going to point this out to me, because I'm getting ready to go into We Agnostics, and in We Agnostics, it's going to ask me, because I'm going to be pushed into my third step right after that. It's asking me to believe that there is something other than me that's going to be able to help me. So The insane part is where this chapter comes in. That I told you before, the insane part, I think I can drink safely. I think it will be different this time. And that's what this whole chapter is about. So here's, on page 32, it gives me my first example. It talks about, here's a man of 30 was doing a great deal of spree drinking. He was very nervous in the morning after these bouts and quieted himself with more liquor. He's going through withdrawals, is what they're saying. He was ambitious to succeed in business. He saw that. He was clear thinking. He knew he wanted to succeed. But he saw that he would get nowhere if he drank at all. He was understanding that he couldn't drink safely, but he had enough self-control to come up with this idea. Once he started, he had no control whatever. He made up his mind that until he had been successful in business and had retired, he would not touch another drop. Okay, so he just planned his relapse, if you see this. This is what he did. Didn't know it, but that's what he did. Okay, an exceptional man who remained bone dry for 25 years and retired at the age of 55 after a successful and happy business career. Then he fell victim to a belief which practically every alcoholic has, that his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink as other men. Out came his carpet slippers and a bottle. In 2 months, he was in a hospital, puzzled and humiliated. He tried to regulate his drinking for a while, making several trips to hospitals, to the hospital. Meantime, then gathering all his forces, he attempted to stop altogether and found he could not. Every means of solving his problem, which money could buy, was at his disposal. Every attempt failed. Though a robust man at retirement, he went to pieces and quickly. And was dead within 4 years. He's the only person that they talk about that died in the book. So, in this case, the case contains a powerful lesson. Most of us have believed that if we remain sober for a long stretch, we could thereafter drink normally, but here is a man who at the age of 55 years found that he was just where he had left off at 30. This is telling me, and I've proven it to myself, that my disease does not go away. It doesn't lessen. My disease is in the parking lot doing push-ups waiting for me. So, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Commencing to drink after a period of sobriety, we are in a short time as bad as ever. So, there's the first guy that gives me an example. So, I don't know if any of you can relate to being sober for a while. Everything quiets down, or I'm just thinking I'm just going to go to the wedding and I'll have the toast and I'll go and have a few drinks or whatever, and then out on a run. I know I can. So it gives me a next example for me that I love is on page 35, and so this is my buddy Jim. And we're going to talk about the normal progression of his day and then where the insanity kicked in for him. So it says, our first example is a friend. We shall call him Jim. This man has a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He had a commendable World War record. He is a good salesman. Everybody likes him. He is an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see, right? Sounds pretty normal and decent guy to me, except for a nervous disposition. He did no drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he became so violent when intoxicated that he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, he came into contact with us. We told him of what we knew about alcoholism. Here's the fellowship coming in, and the answer we had found. He made a beginning, his family was reassembled, and he began to work as a salesman for the business he had lost through drinking. All went well for a time here, warning, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. To his consternation, he found himself drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession. So let's go back to the previous chapter. The fellowship is not enough. It's not enough for me. Maybe it is for you. It's not enough for me. I've got to have something else. This now is reaffirming this. But he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. Okay. He agreed he was a real alcoholic in serious condition. He knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family, for whom he had a deep affection. So he sees the consequences. He knows he's going down. Yet, next page, top of the page, he got drunk again. So we asked him to tell us exactly how it happened. This is his story. So there's the normal things here. It says, I came to work on a Tuesday morning. Okay, what happened to Monday? But we won't talk about that. Who knows? Maybe he starts his week on Tuesday. It's normal, right? It's normal. I remember I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned. That's a normal feeling. I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious. Then I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car. Normal. On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar. That's normal. He's going there to drink, to eat. I had no intention of drinking. Thank you for you reaffirming that. I just thought I would get a sandwich. Normal. I also had the notion that I might find a customer for a car at this place, which was familiar, for I had been going to it for years. I had eaten there many times during the month I was sober. Pretty normal. I sat down at a table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Okay, makes sense. Still no thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. Squiggly lines. What does this mean, right? There's the word. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. It's okay. I ordered a whiskey and poured it into the milk. I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, but felt reassured as I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. So here we go. The experiment went so well that I ordered another whiskey and poured it into more milk. That didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another. Thus started one more journey to the asylum. So here's... I'll end with this because squiggly lines again. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if only he mixed it with his milk. So next to Pat, whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How could such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? So, I think we're at the bottom, but real quick, the bottom of the hour, but real quick, this is setting me up perfectly for We Agnostics, and it's giving me a lot to think about, and we'll hit it next week before we get into We Agnostics, because We Agnostics is a long chapter, but, you know, there's the jaywalker in here,
right.
Which I absolutely couldn't identify until it was explained to me of really what the guy's doing is he just keeps relapsing and there's consequences. He talks about stepping off the curb in front of a fire engine, breaking his back, broken bones, consequences, but he keeps doing it. So a lot of good stuff in here. We're getting into where we're going to hit that second step. So... that's it.
Beautiful.
Thanks for letting me be here.